in, for instance, the part of the Inferno which is given over to lust and to sexual pleasure. The way in which Dante envisions this as being punished, Dante envisions it as being punished at the near the top of hell. That is, it's the least bad sin. If lust is up here, and various forms of betrayal and fraud are at the very bottom. But what Dante the poet envisions that the lustful souls have to do is that he envisions them as like very flighty birds being blown around constantly in a maelstrom, and that they're giving over to pleasure and giving over to pleasure entirely. Never let them put their feet on the ground at all for any kind of genuine commitment. So too, I think the poet Dante is reflecting upon his own actual experience of disordered love early in his life, the inability to make the kind of commitment he needed to make. Well, when Dante finally gets all the way up the mountain of purgatory at the end of the second part of the Divine Comedy, likewise, the thing that's least bad in purgatory is lust, whereas there have been other kinds of sin which have been much heavier therapeutic punishments. But at that point, he envisions the only place where he envisions fire occurring in purgatory, very, very infrequent in hell. But he envisions fire, and he finds that he must go through it, that he must himself embrace it because of the warmth and the excitement and the fascination, but he must let it purify him so that his loves will now be well-ordered and not badly ordered. It's not that the loves have to be knocked out. It's that the loves have to be well-used and well-ordered so that they are appropriately directed with the appropriate kind of commitments to true and genuine goods. Well, in both of these instances, I think we have a strong sense of how pleasure needs to be well-trained. By contrast, I think you see in some other popular modern novels ways in which there is a serious anti-Aristotelian point of view, ways in which there is a sense, if I understand the authors rightly, of how seriously they disagreed with Aristotle in their cultivation of pleasure. I think of something like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. It's one of those novels which I think is like extremely exciting to adolescents because it envisions such a radical new order. And yet what they have in Brave New World is the cultivation of a utilitarian hedonist universe in which everything is established and set up so as progressively to maximize the pleasures, so as progressively to make more sophisticated the use of the reason as an instrument in gaining certain types of pleasures. But the result, of course, is a society in which freedom is non-existent, in which there is no possibility of genuine self-sacrifice for a good higher than oneself, but rather the reduction of the entire ethos of the community toward more and more complicated patterns of using the reason with great sophistication merely for the sake of open hedonism. You find in a particular novel like that and a viewpoint, I think, exactly opposite to Aristotle's, and yet perhaps a kind of a backhanded compliment. Part of the literary conceit of Aldous Huxley in Brave New World is how people could never be brought to this merely by theoretical discussion, merely by lecture or conversation, but how they would need to be habituated into it from the earliest period. And so much of the novel is set in showing how to indoctrinate a whole society precisely by cultivating from the very beginning a delight in certain kind of pleasures and a reinforcement of certain pains and disfavors and shames with other kinds of pleasures. Even though Huxley so severely disagrees with Aristotle, I think, about what the nature of real virtue or real community is, you have there a backhanded compliment in that Huxley readily admits and shows by his literary craft precisely this point that Aristotle is trying to make in service of another vision of what the common good is, about the need for habituation in the pleasures and the possibility of recovery, even for those whose loves have been disordered and disaffected. It will be a very slow process because these things go so deep and begin so early, and yet ultimately happiness very much depends upon ordering our loves rightly and having an appropriate sense of the place of pleasure cultivated after the right ends. It will be to that topic that we turn in the next lecture when we consider the other part of Aristotle's Book 10, his deliberations on the nature of happiness.